Good afternoon, everyone. I usually use a speaker, a microphone that doesn't have a switch on it. Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Palmerston North City Library, the living room of the city. It's lovely to see you all here today, and I am here to kick off the third in our lunchtime series of history talks, local history talks. They have been really, really fantastic so far, so I have no doubt that this afternoon's talk is going to be really enjoyable. I would like to now ask Philippa Elphick, our New Zealand and Pacific Island Zone librarian, to come forward to introduce our very special speaker.
Right, it's my pleasure today to be introducing Leslie Courtney. For those of you that don't know, Leslie Courtney is our city archivist, and she has worked in that position for, she tells me, nearly 5 years now. So that kind of surprised me, that, you know, time passes so quickly and it's been nearly 5 years. But I believe it's been a good 5 years. I had a chat to Leslie yesterday, and she said that her interest in archives was actually sparked while she was out at Massey, studying at Massey, and through people that she met out there. And one person she mentioned in particular was Lucy Marsden, who's here today. Hi, Lucy. Lucy at the time was the archivist out at Massey, and Leslie, as part of her research, was using the archives, and she said her interest was really sparked by finding out what an archivist did, and in fact using the archives and finding out what archives were. So that's where the interest was sparked. Now she tells me that she has the best job in the world, so we don't want to spread that around too much because a few of us have got that here. It's one of those, I guess, fortuitous things where your passion becomes your profession. So we're very lucky to have Leslie here today. The topic today is the Houses of Massey. Leslie's interest in Massey started really when she undertook her research topic for her BA Honours on the women of Massey Agricultural College. So it's quite a nice flow into her talk today, which is on the Houses of Massey. So please welcome Leslie Courtney. I'm sure we're going to have an entertaining talk this lunchtime. Thank you.
I'm just going to pull this forward a wee bit, just so I can actually see the screen as well. Yeah.
Right here?
Yep. Okay. Hello. That's working? Is that working? It's meant to be. It is turned on. Yeah, it's working. Okay.
It is working.
Yeah. Okay. Put it a wee bit higher. It's lovely to see everybody here today. I've listened to two of the talks this week, and I just hope that I am going to at least spark your interest as much as the last two speakers have. So it's been a wonderful week so far. I'm going to talk about the Houses of Massey, and and by that I mean the houses that have been absorbed into what is now Massey University, some of those wonderful old homes that we had in this area. To put it sort of in perspective, just to go back a little bit, something you probably all know, that of course the government bought the large block of land, Ahuturanga, in about 1863, which was to open up the Manawatū for settlement. J.T. Stewart was sent up as the government surveyor, and during 1865 to 66 he surveyed the area looking at where they would place a town so that would be the centre of this district. And of course that town is Palmerston North. The ideal spot that was found, it had been seen before J.T. Stewart came here, was of course this clearing, a clearing in the bush, which they called Papioea. And this clearing just west of the river is exactly on the spot that we are today, and from there they set out their town that was to open up this area. And they put a lovely big square in the middle, which remains today as planned. And it had the four main roads leading off the square. And of course, one, Fitzherbert Avenue, led down to the river. And it was down that road that many of the families that I'm going to talk about today used frequently. In 1870, people really started to arrive and develop Palmerston North. At the same time, across the river, that land, of course, came up for sale, even though it was not part of the borough of Palmerston North when this became its own borough. So that land, in fact, never came into the city until 1989 with the government, local government restructuring. But as you can imagine, just being so close to the town, this was their town. And they certainly identified fully with Palmerston North, even though they were not the ratepayers of the town. And in 1871, Sir James Prendergast bought a very large block of land directly across the river in what was to become Fitzherbert, to be called Fitzherbert. And he had a large block, and there were other smaller blocks that were sold off from that time onwards. So this talk really, I suppose in some ways, is very much based upon Dorothea Joblin's book. If you've never seen or heard of Dorothea Joblin, she was an author who lived here locally, and she wrote this rather delightful book. I don't know whether one could call it an academic read by any means, and I must admit it was probably the second reading of the book that I actually saw the little delights that was that were contained inside it. The first time through, I probably felt it was rather fanciful writing, but in fact, Dorothea Joblin did research. She did talk to family members of these homes. And of course, this was in the late 60s. So she was talking to people who had lived in these homes and remembered those times. So what Dorothea Joblin did for us was, in fact, she recorded a story that may get lost over time. So it's a very nice little read. It's a book that's in the library and can be borrowed and enjoyed if you're interested in what we're hearing today. So I'm going to start with the houses, and I'm going to start with the date that they were actually built. There may be a bit of chopping and changing depending on what happens to the house at the end. So the first... So this gives us an idea of the town. The green area shows the Papioea clearing area, and you've got this wonderful road that led straight down to the river. It did lead straight down to a river that had no bridge for a number of years, but I believe that for much of the time it was quite easy to ford. And these are the houses I'm going to talk about. This is a very crude map, I have to admit, but it just kind of places where the houses are. So if you take this as being the road that's coming around from the bridge, this is the ring road as you go into Massey University. This is the bachelor home, Willowbank. Here we've got the Kyler home, Atterfy, Fodderata, the Russell home. We've got Craig Lockhart, which was the Munro home. We have Turitea, which I'll explain why it looks so strange, which was built by Richard Abrahams. And we've got an arrow leading into a wide space, which was where Lawrence Burke lived. And those are the houses I'll be discussing. I'm going to start with John Batchelor's home, J.O., as he was usually called. He bought his land. He was a publican at the Royal Hotel in Palmerston North, where he lived with his wife and six children. They had lived there for a time and decided that they wanted to move out of town and become farmers and develop the land. They bought the land directly on the nice river flats over the bridge. So here, this corner here is just sort of directly across the bridge from as we come round, and the road skirting around the bluff through here. And this was the home he built here. They moved out there sometime in the late 1870s, and the first thing he built was the two-storey stable, which I'm presuming is this building here in the photo. He built that, and the family lived there for, said to be about 2 years while he built the house. He built it himself. He was meant to be a builder as well. A man of many talents, obviously. He built Willow Bank. Now, it was certainly a substantial two-storied home, wooden home, but no frills particularly. I imagine it was it had size, but when you went inside, it was a fairly ordinary sort of place that then went on to accommodate their 11 children as well as themselves. So he was not a gentleman farmer, so to speak. He was a man who had been self-made, and he and his sons worked the land. So he was certainly a hands-on farmer. According to Dorothea Joblin, quite a formidable man if the children ran into him and had a lot to do with him. And I believe that the sons certainly did as they were told as they were working on the farm. So here we have another view of the house looking down from the bluff. So you can see it was certainly a sizeable property. He farmed the land quite extensively and successfully. Here's J.O. and his wife and all of their 11 children. Obviously, she had children over a large number of years. This is one of his sons, Joss, and his son. So this is taken about 1900, farming that land along the flats there. In 1908, J.O. and his wife moved back into town. They retired off the farm, and they left the farm in the hands of Liz and her husband and Arthur, who in fact remained single for a lot of his life. He married quite later in life. So they remained out there, but it wasn't very long afterwards that J.O. and his wife returned back to Willow Bank, their farm and their home, and they substantially altered it. They employed LG West to come and obviously, they had more money by this time. So you can see at this stage, compared to the last, they put in bay windows, they had balconies, they added on a billiards room, which was a mark of somebody who had some money at the time. They put in a tennis court, they had a croquet lawn established. So they did quite a lot of extensive alterations to the house. This is just a family occasion. This is one of the daughters, Lillian, and it was her wedding on the steps, taken about 1910. Oops, going ahead of myself now. So this, in fact, was the home that was first sold to Massey. J.O. died 1925, I think I'm right there. 1925 he died and Elizabeth followed a year later. At that point the property came up for sale. This was at the time where the government was looking around to establish a second agricultural college in New Zealand for the North Island. Lincoln was well established by that time. There were many sites suggested. Martin was quite strong, a strong contender for that site, and Palmerston North, of course, was in fact as a town doing its best to obtain that agricultural college for themselves. So they saw this land. It was a well-established and successful farm. It had good land, and it was obviously a great place to establish an agricultural college. The fact that another of the large houses also came up for sale at the same time probably perhaps swung the deal in Palmerston North's favour. So this was the house that Massey Agricultural College took up, and in 1928 when it opened, this was the site of the offices and the classrooms. People were accommodated in town at that time. The bachelor home, unfortunately, is one of the few that has since been demolished, 1980s. So, I don't know what that's saying. Just click that one off, could you? Thanks. And there is a plaque on a large oak tree down on the Bachelor Flats. Just say okay, I think. And there was a plaque put on the tree there, so you can still find that on the Bachelor Flats. And that oak tree was said to be planted by J.O. in about 1883 in his garden. The next person, the next home I'm going to go to was further up the road. The road, of course, was just a gravel road at that time called Riverbank Road, and it wound around and roughly opposite where the entrance to Massey is now, up on the rise, was where Charles Munro bought land. Now, Charles Munro was a gentleman. He came from a well-respected family. His father was Speaker of the House of Representatives. He'd been schooled in England and was... I'm not going to say too much about it because you'll all come back tomorrow to hear more about this. He was also the man who supposedly introduced rugby to New Zealand, bringing it back when he returned to New Zealand. So Charles Munro settled in Palmerston North, and he bought this piece of land, which was almost surrounded by Bachelor land as well, a bit further along. He had about 51 acres up on the rise, and it went down the bank, and he had a bit of flat land below. This is sort of coming around the corner. It's a bit hard to see in here. It's a bit light, and the photo is rather large, but this is in fact the home he built. So this would be the road as you're curving around to come up towards Massey University as we know it now. This is obviously taken a little bit later. He built the home, which they called Craig Lockhart, after his wife's family home. And it was certainly a substantial home. It was very nicely appointed. This was a man who had some money. He was sort of in business, so to speak, in investments. And he kind of worked in town, like a gentleman would, but he also had a passion for gardening. So he developed his 51 acres. He put in gardens around the house up the top. He had a vineyard, perhaps the first vineyard in Manawatu, one might think, sort of on the slopes, apparently. He put an orchard in down below. He also planted a lot of native trees and had a native area. So he was really quite passionate about his garden completely. His home, he was also very passionate about music. When his drawing room had a 15-foot stud, which he built to make the acoustics just right for the piano and for singing. That, in fact, was later built down. The ceiling was lowered and a room was actually put in above that later on. It was still very much a home, though. This was... my impressions of the Munros were that while they certainly moved in the right social circles in Palmerston North and knew the right people, they also had a nice upbringing. And I really say that from the photos we hold of the Munros. It gives an insight into a family. They had five children that had a very carefree sort of existence. They had two girls. This is their youngest boy, and that's him and his wife Helena, obviously taken at the same time. This may be the native area that he established. This is the children down at the river. The Turitea stream ran along the bottom of their property. I think that's a lovely photo. This shows the power of photographs to not only give us information, but to remind us of things as well. I think that was more towards Kahutarawa Way holidaying up there. This is sort of their mattresses tied up that they were taking with them. So to me, it spells a life of a rather idyllic sort of childhood, that they did spend time with their father and their parents and did a lot of nice, interesting carefree sorts of things. Just making sure I haven't missed too much. The house was quite substantial. It did have the two sets of stairs. They certainly had servants and maintained it that way. Charles Munro had actually, over the years, sold off some of his land, and he and leased out part of his 51 acres to people. And in 1931, I think, he actually offered his property to the government for the college. The government thought he was asking too much. This was a businessman, obviously quite astute, and didn't want to take him up on that offer. So he kept his land. It wasn't all the 51 acres by that time, so he kept his place. And it wasn't until 10 years later, 1943, so it must have been about 33, he offered it to the government. In 1943, in fact, the government bought the property. And they accepted it for Massey. Now, at that stage, in 1943, the college was expanding, but also they bought it expressly as an accommodation for women students. Women had always been accepted into Massey Agricultural College. There'd never been, in fact, perhaps for the first one or two years, they may have had no women, but virtually there were women all the way through. But really during the war years, when the men were away at the war, the women came in much larger numbers, and particularly when they started the horticultural course, which began during the 1940s. And so there was much larger numbers of women on campus, and they needed to accommodate those girls. They needed to look after them because they were like their parents, that they'd been entrusted with their care. So this was an ideal place. It was across the road. It meant all those naughty boys that were living across at Massey University would not be able to be too close to them. But, of course, they did manage quite well in getting very close, I believe, from all the stories. But the idea was that they were in a more private sort of area from the college. It accommodated, so it was called at that time Magini House. Now, Mrs. Magini came from Auckland. She left some money to the college. Now, from what I found out when I did research this, I couldn't really see a link from Mrs. Magini necessarily to providing accommodation for women, but that was what they decided to use with her bequest, and so it became Magini House after her, and affectionately called Mog House, which it remained for a long time. So this is... this is in the time of the girls. This is a photo taken about 1944. Girls there. Professor Perrin, of course, was not a person to waste any money on frivolous things. So the horticultural students, of course, looked after all the gardens as well, which included the gardens around the accommodation. It accommodated 26 girls. It had some Nissen huts that were added around the outside of the property as well, outside of the sort of the back area of the house. So this remained as accommodation and does till this day. It is no longer exclusive to women, of course. It's now used, a few years ago I know I talked up there, and it was mainly used by mature students, and they sort of gave it to perhaps couples even who wanted a university room. It seems very unaltered inside. You certainly can get the impression of what it was like. And it's now reverted to the name Craig Lockhart, which is rather nice as well. This photo was taken in the 1970s, still as accommodation. So as you can see, looking very much the same, if you can think back to that photo of the Munros outside on the lawn, very unaltered, if there's such a word. Right, the third house I'm going to move on to is a house that we certainly all know, probably the best known house, but I have to say, I do think it's got very tenuous sort of links with Massey. I've included it because Dorothea Joblin included it, and it does certainly do have some links. It does have some links. Now, this is the, thank you, this is unrecognisable, probably slightly, but this is in fact Centennial Lagoon, so behind it we have Casey Birch House. This was as Jacob Nannestad built the house in 1892, and he was the sawmiller with Richter Nannestad and Jensen, who cleared the bush from the Hokafetu area. Nannestad had a large pocket of land for himself. He built his house, and he actually sold off sections as well. And this was the original building as built by LG West, as designed by LG West. In 1903, Nannestad sold his property to Jack Strang. Jack Strang was sort of a farmer, gentleman farmer, who became who invested in the Manawatu Meat Company. He had a young family of three boys that he bought to what was then called Woodhay. Actually, yes, I just realised I got that wrong. Craig Lockhart was named after Charles Munro's family. Woodhay was named after Jack Strang's wife's family, family home. They called it Woodhay, and they substantially altered it in 1903, got LG West to add on additions to the home to make it from a much plainer home into the place that we probably recognise a lot today. It was certainly a substantial home. It certainly had the upstairs downstairs feel to it. Probably just about everyone in this room has been in KC Birch for some reason today, and so obviously walls have been knocked out, but essentially the outside is pretty much as it was, and you can still see the bones of the house when you walk around it completely. So Jack Strang owned the house in 1903, did those alterations. As people would want to do in those days, often they would take lengthy holidays back home to England, and which he did from 1908 to 1910. In that time, it became the official residence of the Governor General of New Zealand. In 1907, a fire had burnt the residence in Wellington, so this property was seen to be a good home for the Governor General down in the lower part of the North Island. Because of that, there were also alterations then made to the house again for the Governor General, most of which were footed by the government, so that was quite nice. Some, of course, were just slight alterations, such as the sentry box at the gate to allow people to enter and leave. They put in the tennis courts. They put in a remote mobile buildings at the back, which housed the staff and offices. And they also added on the billiard room, which is still there today. But that was jointly funded by Jack Strang and the government, because it was going to remain there, and he was going to obviously benefit from this addition. This is just another view, looking across from the other side, looking more from the across Centennial Lagoon, so you're more at the Gulf Links area, and looking across there. Oops, went a bit fast then. The beautiful fireplace, which remains there as you walk into the hall, that lovely area. This was the Strang boys with their governess. Quite a privileged sort of lifestyle at that time. Only one of the boys is a Strang boy, and the other two are cousins, I think. But that's in the driveway at Casey Birch. Children's party in the garden. In 1921, I think I'm right, wasn't 1920? Yes, in 1921, the house was then sold by the Strangs, and it was sold to William Catcher Birch, as the family pronounces it. William and Maud arrived in their retirement. They'd had a big station up in Hawke's Bay and decided to retire down to this area. So they spent their retirement years here. But it was also very much a family home in that they had their grown-up children with grandchildren very close by. Did I press something? I bet I'm going too slow. Who used this property and came and spent a lot of time here. So it was very much a family home still with these people. Luckily, a lot of the family, and in fact, I don't see Sue here today. She was here the other day. This is Sue, who has just returned to live in Palmerston North as a grandchild of the Catcher Birches. And she remembers, and the family remember it very affectionately. The gardens were wonderful to play in. They had the punt on the lagoon. There was a sand pit for them. They remembered the rose garden that Maud Catcher Birch developed and grew in the gardens. So it was very privileged. There were certainly servants still in this time, but very fond memories from those grandchildren that were there. And Willie, as he was called, Willie died in 1936, and from that point onwards, really, the government, first of all, the city council purchased the lagoon and some other land around the lagoon to use for the city, and then in 1941, the land, the house and the gardens were gifted to the government. So the government used it. It's got quite an interesting past, Catcher Birch House, or Casey Birch House, as we tend to call it. It was used by the government as a military staff training school during the war. It then went on to become a convalescence home for nurses who had returned from the front after the war from 1946 for a few years. And then in the late 1950s, it was given over to what they called the University College, which was coming to Palmerston North. Now, the University College was kind of like an outpost from Victoria University that was going to set up the first university in Palmerston North. In fact, over the next few years, what really happened was that University College and Massey Agricultural College, to put it very briefly, amalgamated together, and Massey University became the university in 1964. So, in fact, Casey Birch was never used by the University College, but that's when it kind of came into the university's hands. The university didn't want to really use it. It had it was further away and it had its own accommodation. So it was used by the College of Education for some time. By the 1970s, but 1976 onwards, really, it was basically getting into disrepair and it was unused. It had a very uncertain future for a number of years, and it was really by the goodwill of a number of people who could see the potential of this wonderful home that eventually the Palmerston North City Council accepted it as a gift, and or did they buy it for a dollar? It was one of those sort of ones, and they took it on, and even then it was unsure what they were going to do with it. And now, of course, we have this wonderful venue centre, which seems very successful and is at least a way of preserving these wonderful old homes. This, I think, is a really fascinating photo, if you can see it. This was taken about 1941 at the time it came into the government's hands, but it gives you some idea. Te Awi Awi Street, as you can see, is still almost like a rural little road at this point, with the grass, looks one lane. Coming up the driveway still, you can see some of the sections have developed quite substantial homes around the garden. But the driveway is still quite a sweeping driveway, much more private looking, the tennis court, and you can see the lagoon. So I think that's rather a wonderful look at the homestead. Moving on now, and I better move really quickly. I've got to talk fast or abridge greatly. This is Arthur Russell. He also was a retired farmer, a man who'd married a bit later in life. So he had a young family when he decided to buy land off James Prendergast, who had subdivided in 1900. So in 1900, Arthur Russell came and built his house almost across the road from Craig Lockhart, and it's what we know as Whorirata. It was called Whorirata, which means home of red, because he had a red beard, and apparently the Maori people where he'd come from had called him Redbeard. And so Whorirata, which was two words in those days, they named their home. Arthur Russell was a very well-respected man and very well-liked, from what I can understand about him. This is actually, this is a marvellous photo. Once again, I apologise, it's quite hard to see. This is Craig Lockhart across the road, and this is actually the building of Whorirata in 1900. So it's still got its scaffolding up. And this is the road leading up to it. This is the actual road and the driveway coming in. Right. Lovely. Oh, great. Oh, thank you, Lucy. Yeah, so there's quite a little history in that as well, and it's just wonderful to have that. Here's Whorirata. This is a little bit later, this photo, of course. And there has been changes over the years. It was designed by Natouche, a Napier architect, and it was extended about 5 years after it was built. And again, after Arthur Russell's death, when Mrs. Russell arrived back from Europe with apparently mountains of furniture that she'd bought, and she couldn't accommodate it, so she had to build on. I believe that Mrs. Russell was quite a formidable woman. She was, I think most people who came in contact with her knew that who she mixed with and her relationships with people were quite clear, I think. She definitely ran a household along sort of Victorian lines of them and us, and there's a wonderful article in the paper where somebody interviewed a former cook there in the 1940s, and just how she found it, that the pantry was unlocked in the morning, the ingredients for the day were taken out, and the pantry was locked again in case the staff might actually inadvertently use some extra provisions or something. The silver each night went up to Mrs. Russell's bedroom and slept in her bedroom with her and were brought down the next day to be used. So she was a woman who certainly had a lifestyle that remained probably from years before that many people had discarded by that time. And she lived there with her daughter Beatrix, who was unmarried, until Arthur Russell died in 1924. He was quite a bit older than her, and she lived until 1949. It was said that while she leased a paddock to the Massey Agricultural College that they used as a rugby field, that she would look at Professor Perrin and she said, "You will not have my land until I die. You know, you think you're going to get it, but you're not." And true to her word, he did not get it until she passed away in 1949. And in 1951, the land actually came to Massey Agricultural College. It has housed classrooms in the past and is preserved today as the Massey Club sort of thing, and it's used as a venue and a conference centre. And basically, I think, once again, while there are alterations, you can still see the structure of the house. You can see your way around and what it must have been like. This one's in the 30s. Right, the next person that I'll only touch on briefly, mainly because I don't know a huge amount about him, although we have had some family members in recently, so that's interesting. This is Lawrence Burke. Lawrence Burke was very much a self-made farmer. He had bought land further up towards, I think, Kohutarawa Way, and in 1900 he also bought land off James Prendergast and developed a dairy farm sort of in behind the Russells. He bought it on the Russells' property. Did not move in the same social circles, from what I would understand, to the Russells. The granddaughter remembered that each day one of the servants would come across and get the milk and cream for the Russells and take it back home. So they were neighbours in that sense, really, only, possibly. He was very successful, though. He established a very good dairy farmer. He did very well for himself. I believe he built, compared to the other homes, a relatively modest villa, I'm not quite sure what happened to that villa. I'm presuming it was pulled down, but it may have been shifted. I actually don't know. You don't know, Lucy? No. There's sort of no memory of what actually happened to the house. But that land was acquired in 1946 on Lawrence Burke's death by Massey, and of course it was used as farmland at that stage in behind. The next place we go to is Richard Slingsby Abraham's house. Richard Abraham was co-established Abraham and Williams, the stock and station agents. He built the house Turitea. Now, Turitea was also the property that came up for sale at the same time as the Bachelor Homestead and helped sway the government to putting the agricultural college where it was. We don't have a lot of photographs of Turitea itself, but this is looking across. I think I worked out at one stage Fororata's roof, which is seen there, so I'm thinking it was taken further along the bluff, looking at it from the side on of Turitea. Very substantial home. 28 rooms. Huge high ceilings. I believe when you walked in, there was this beautiful foyer that you walked into with the big staircase going up and the gallery around the top where the bedrooms went off. A beautiful home. We don't have any photographs of the family actually living there at that time, unfortunately. This is another interesting photograph, and it shows the three. Here's Turitea sitting up in its magnificent site. Through here is Fororata, so you can see they were relatively close neighbours, and the Munros. Now, all three of these families certainly did move in the same sort of social circles and did see each other outside of just being neighbours. In 2021, the house was sold to the McCardys, and it became known as the McCardy Homestead. And it was there that they sold it in 1926, and that was the site that was bought. Now, in fact, it was not the government who bought it. It was, in fact, bought by the city council, or the town council as it was then, the borough council, sorry. The borough council, trying to entice this agricultural college here, said, if you buy the Bachelor Homestead and farm, we will buy Turitea in this wonderful site and we will gift it to you if you bring your agricultural college here. And that is what happened. They then gifted it on to the government, who saw it as their site. Now, this was seen as the site for the college. The Bachelor Homestead was down on the ground, and in 1928 that's where they opened, but I think right from the beginning they envisaged that this was where the college was going to be set, up here on this rise, this bluff, this terrace. And I'll just go back a little bit. So what they did was in 1928 they started, and then they decided that, of course, the magnificent site that Turitea was on, this was not a big enough place to start it. So what they did was they actually cut the house in half and moved it back. And it remains today. On the site of the house on that point is the old main building, as we now call it, at Massey University. And that was built and opened in 1931, and all the classrooms went up there, up to the terrace. The half the house went directly back, straight back from the old main building where it is now, and that remains today as the Vice-Chancellor's residence. I've never had the privilege to be in it. Lucy, have you? Yes. I believe it's still beautiful inside, and it's maintained that feeling of the old home. The other half went to the side, moved around, this is the old main building, went to the side, and it was used as the first registry and office block. And it's not so glamorous. You can go in there and you wouldn't really know exactly where it had come from. Right, and I think I just might have time to whip through this one. Our last home is Atifi. Right, now this was built further along the terrace from Turitea, moving along, and this was also part of James Prendergast's estate. And it was bought by Edwin Kyler and his brothers. They were farmers, and the reason he bought it was that his wife, his very young wife, had just recently died of tuberculosis, and they farmed out at Raumai, and he was looking for a healthy site, really, for his family. He was quite concerned. And so he built this wonderful home. This was another Natouche designed home. Beautiful big windows. It had apparently magnificent views. It's virtually almost at the end of Fitzherbert Avenue. Not quite, but you know, they could look right across the river at the town. And it was very large. Only 17 rooms, but very large rooms. And 15-foot stud downstairs, 12-foot stud upstairs. A wonderful place. This is taken a lot later, but shows the extent of the building at the back. To this house came Mr. and Mrs. Potts, who were his wife's parents, and they bought the two children. So they moved in while the brothers stayed out on the farm, and it was really the Pottses who developed the gardens and the home. And it was Mrs. Potts who named it Atifi, which means warm welcome. Quite a homely look to it, though, by these photographs. This is a family wedding, not sure whose it is. It's not one of the children. Whether this is one of the children, I don't know. They may be the Kyler children. That's about 1908 or something, I think. And at this point, these had been glassed in, the verandas. This was taken in 1930. Unfortunately, Eddie Kyler, as he was known, was also died young. He died about 2 years after the house was built, which was very sad. And his brothers came into town as well, and it stayed in the family. Brian Kyler, who was the son, actually took over the home, and he raised his family in here. In 1962, he sold it to the government for the college. He didn't sell it to the government. He sold it to the Presbyterian Trust, who were going to establish it as a hostel for male students. Bernard Ferguson opened it in 1963, and so they called it Ferguson Hall. So they unfortunately took away that wonderful name, and it's still Ferguson Hall, as far as I know. Does Lucy? Does it? Yeah. So there's now other hostels built around it. At the time, they built on some low-level accommodation as well. When it was first built, there was no access to it up that steep bluff. You know, when you first go over the bridge and you come around, it's very steep up there. There was no access to it, and they actually hauled the makings of the house up the cliff. And when the house was built, they put in the road. It sort of seemed an odd way round to do it to me, but that was the way they did it. So everything that was in this house was hauled up. Then they had a very steep access road. And that, when it became a hostel, they closed off that steep road, and then they built in an access way by Clifton Terrace to eliminate that. Wonderful gardens. A sunken garden. In fact, Maud Catcher Birch, who had married Willie, she was actually a sister of the, she was a Kyler, she was a sister of the Kyler brothers who built this house. That's really sort of the end of my talk. I think that these are some wonderful old homes. We had many wonderful old homes in Palmerston North. Unfortunately, so many of them have been lost to us. They've been pulled down. There's not been a purpose for them anymore. People can't run large homes. And I believe that these homes that went to Massey Agricultural College were, in fact, that was a blessing in disguise. Most of those homes have been preserved. They haven't been radically altered. And apart from the bachelor home, they've been maintained and they're well looked after, and I'm sure they will for the future. So, in fact, that was wonderful that they went into their hands, because there is a use established for them. There's just a last couple of photos which just gives you some perspective on the college. Down here we have the bachelor area. Here we've got Whararata, the old main building. We've got the two parts of Turitea sitting here. The refectory down below, if you know Massey. This is a later one taken in the 1960s, looking down, still much more rural, more hostile development out here that began in World War II. And Whararata still looking semi-isolated, so you can see how Mrs. Russell cocooned herself in there for a long time and pretended that college probably didn't exist next door to her. So I hope that sparked some of your memories, because I'm sure a lot of you people know these homes and have seen them, and has maybe just reminded you of a few things if it hasn't told you anything new. So thank you. Thank you.
And Charles Monroe was my grandfather, and I used to go out to Craig Lockett during school holiday times and sleep in the bedroom in the mezzanine floor, wake up in the morning and hear the cows and the magpies and things. It's very vivid memory. And we used to go out every Sunday afternoon to visit my grandmother.
Lovely.
Charles' widow, Lenita, died at the age of about 94. And amongst Charles's, besides having introduced rugby football into New Zealand, he was the first president of the Manawatu Golf Club. He was president of the Gentlemen's Club, and he was involved in polo. And 5 acres. It's nearly completed, of writing a book about Charles Monroe, and when it's completed, I would encourage everybody to buy a copy.
Ah, right.
So, I'm not quite sure. I think his father was derived from a brother of the one that was on the screen.
Right.
But thank you very much indeed for your address, and I hope I haven't stolen anybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leslie. That was very wonderful. See, I said it. Before we go on, do we have any more questions? I'm sure there's lots of questions that you're thinking you might like to ask Leslie. Has she told us everything? Okay. If there's no more questions or anything anyone would like to add to the talk. Oh, yes, here we are.
Richard Abraham. Oh. Richard Abraham was my grandfather. So, yes.
You need to...
Yeah. Where it was, you know, when it was cut up into two bits, and but I've never actually seen them. So,
Pam, no. Oh, what was that? You loved seeing
the building in two halves.
Turitea.
Mm.
Okay. Well, Philippa just made a comment then that all of these little stories that are coming out from these talks, that's the magic of Local History Week. And something that Philippa mentioned yesterday, you know, here we are having this lovely week of sharing stories and hearing new stories perhaps, or adding to the stories, and I think that's something that's really special about having a week like this, which we do hope will continue. We're already sort of thinking about plans for next year and what we'll be doing, so we hope this is the beginning of something really special for the library and for the Palmerston North. I'm going to move on to a little bit of a commercial break now. Talking about our Local History Week, it's going from April the 7th to the 13th, so it's a very full week, and we've still got more treats in store for you. So today, we're at the middle of our lunchtime talks, but we still have two more talks to come, and tomorrow we have the very, very special treat of early rugby in the Manawatū. And so please do come back tomorrow. We would love to see you all, and bring your friends and your families and tell everybody, and your sandwiches, because we can have our lunch here. So do come. That will be Clive Akers sharing the history of rugby, which I think, and well, if you live in my house, rugby's one of the most important things that happens. So I had better be there. Also today, we start our lovely series of walks. I'm probably not quite up on it, but they're filling up fast. I don't think there's any very many spare places. They're quite full. But if there is a walk that you're interested in, do perhaps check and see whether it's full. Let us know, because I'm sure that we'll be able to organise something else in the future, perhaps. The walks will be really interesting and very enjoyable. And also tomorrow, I just want to, you'll all have this lovely program. If you don't, we've still got some copies available. Grab one. Also, perhaps take one away and hand it on to your friends. Tomorrow we have the launch of Pātaka Ipurangi, Manawatū Memory Online. That's our fantastic new digital library that Philippa and Leslie and a team of library staff have been working on for the last little while. And we finally get to share it with you. The launch will be tomorrow at 6 p.m. down in our sound and vision zone. We have a lovely guest for that. Jock Phillips is coming up from Wellington. He's the editor of Tiara. And he is a historian, so his talk should be very, very interesting and well worth coming to, and he'll be a lovely man to meet. So please do come and join us for that evening. It's a very special evening for the city, I think. So it just leaves me now to say thank you all for coming. It's lovely, lovely to have you here, and... In your library, your living room of the city, please keep coming. We just love having you here and enjoy. Thank you, and thank you, Leslie, and thank you, Philippa. That was... Thank you. Please do stay. Talk to Leslie. Talk to any of us that you'd like to chat to. Talk amongst yourselves. Thank you.